listening to Heritage Radio Network on tour. We are broadcasting live today from the Le Creuset podcast studio at Charleston Wine and Food. My name is Kat Johnson, and my panel right now is one of my most highly anticipated panels of the festival. We are joined by Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills. Welcome, Glenn.
Hi, how are you doing, Kat?
He's back. He was here last year. We talked about Sapelo Island Purple Ribbon Cane. We're going to have a similar conversation today, but about a different plant. We are also joined by Ann Marshall and Scott Blackwell of Highwire Distilling. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Ann was on earlier this weekend talking about the world's biggest cookie, her former life as a bakery owner. Now she and her husband Scott own Highwire. And we talked about the similarities a little bit between the ingredients and processes of baking and distilling. But Scott, this is your first time joining us.
Yes.
Welcome.
I'm a newbie.
You are.
Thanks.
So let's talk a little bit about Highwire. How did you guys decide to open up a distillery in Charleston?
Well, we had owned the bakery and it had gotten really big, and we had lost a little bit of that touch with what we were making and doing. And Scott had been brewing beer at our house for probably a year, and he was really fired up about opening a brewery. And we sold the bakery, and it kind of came down to brass tacks as to what we were going to do next. And I was really wary of opening a brewery because there were just so many. So I put a bug in his ear about maybe taking it to the next level. And he went along with it. So I sort of hoodooed him into...
Yeah, I was doubting, actually, for about 3 years after we opened the distillery, actually.
Wait, but when did you say, this is now a good idea?
No, it was, I mean, you know, I just, brewing, you know, had, and Ann was, I think, the right decision. But distilling was still fairly young at that point. There were only a couple hundred, maybe 150 distilleries when we first started looking at it. And I said, can we make a living? Is anybody really making a living as a craft distiller? And kind of what are we bringing? What does the word craft mean? And what are we doing that we're going to bring that, you know, isn't offered already? And I didn't really, we had never distilled. So, you know, it was kind of like a major finger in the wind of like, well, A, we've never distilled anything. And B, you know, we don't really have any good examples around here that we can point to say, yeah, we could do something like that and pay our bills. So we went to Oregon, and the first place we walked into was a distillery, and this guy had, there was stuff everywhere. And he goes, hey, the owner walks up, he goes, hey, what are you guys doing? I said, oh, you know, we're here checking it out. We're thinking about opening a distillery on the East Coast. He's like, oh yeah, it's great, man. I just quit my day job. I've been doing this for 8 years. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
It took 8 years? Boy.
I was like, we don't have 8 years.
Nor do we want two jobs. Yeah. Although, you know, our company's pretty small, so we each have about 7 jobs.
But it's all at one company.
Yes.
Which makes a difference.
Just all at one company.
Yeah. So I'm curious kind of like how the three of you met, how far back you go, and how you sort of collaborated.
That's a good lead-in.
Well,
this conversation we're having is a good
Glenn, lead-in. You know, we called Glenn a couple of times, and he continued to ignore my phone calls.
Glenn's making
Uh-oh.
A face.
Wait, is this going to involve the Supreme Court?
And then, oh, gosh. And then this guy named Rathead Riley walks in the distillery one day. And if you don't know Rathead, he is like the mayor of Southern Food and Beverage. He sells insurance, oddly enough. But he is a huge advocate for the Southern Foodways Alliance. And that's how we met Rathead. Rathead said, is there anything I can do for you before I leave town? And we were like, yeah, we're having a really hard time getting in touch with Glenn Roberts. And we feel like we really need to talk to him before we dig into building a whiskey program. And Rathead left the distillery, and 5 minutes later, Glenn called my cell phone.
I do everything Ann Marshall, Scott Blackwell, and Riley say to do.
I think
especially
Glenn,
Rathead.
Knowing Glenn now, you were probably in a rice field without phone service. I mean, it was like
you were probably also like, who are these yo-yos that say they want to, you know? Use.
We met long before that, apparently, and I'd forgotten.
We did, right? Yeah. We'd met about 5 years before that at a slow food event in Greenville, South Carolina. So
that was fun.
So the phone call led to, and this phone call sort of was a premeditated attempt to say, okay, what is our place? And knowing, being a food person, I knew that, you know, just like tomatoes or mushrooms, all grains aren't created equal. And the backbone of bourbon is corn. So I said, the first place we need to dig into is corn. And I know there's this guy in South Carolina that knows a lot about corn and grain in general. So that was sort of the reasoning. And we realized that we needed help. And we had a conversation with Glenn in like December, I guess it was. And then this was the 2 months after we opened. And you were down at Clemson's Research Center a month or so later, maybe like late January. He said, let's meet down at Clemson. We'll talk about corn. And I showed up and there was a 6-foot table full of all sorts of varieties. And Glenn's going through the different seeds, and this one's this, and this was this, and this is the quality of this, and this is what the flavor of this. And he kept skipping around this one in the middle of the table. And I said, yeah, well, what about that one? And he goes, oh, yeah, that's Jimmy Red. That's the one you want. He's like, that's an old hooch corn.
Hooch corn.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Hooch. What? And hooch is actually out of the genre and tropes from the Prohibition era. And I don't know its etymology, but it is used in gas stations all around Appalachia. And anywhere, like there's a place called Tyner, South Carolina, that's like an eye blink, but it's a wonderful place. It's right on the South Carolina, North Carolina border. And that was the first place I actually heard that term. That was 25 years ago.
So right? This Jimmy Red corn is like a corn that is for what reason is Jimmy Red corn great for distilling? What characteristics?
Well, we didn't know originally, and I thought, what does Glenn know about distilling? But he seems to be fairly confident about this. Well, he didn't really tell us at that point, but he had had some of this stuff back in the day.
I drank gallons of it.
So he
knows his way around.
But then I said, great, we need to make some of that. He goes, well, great. We can get you some seed, and then you're going to have to grow it because there's not enough for you to even make a batch of it. And so we worked with Clemson that summer, and I went down, myself and Ann went down probably every other week. I was down there at least every week watching it go in the ground to germing to coming up through. And I'm not a farm person, so it was all very interesting to me, kind of what was going on, but also I didn't understand the sort of stages of it. But when the corn came on the cob and drops and it turns that deep red, I got really excited. And it's just more of an angst of hope, I guess. And at that point, we didn't have a way to get it out of the field. It had been raining for 23 days, so we called in a bunch of volunteers, a bunch of folks that are here this weekend, chefs and bartenders and friends. Glenn was there. We went in and hand broke the 2.5 acres, and then we had no way to clean it or mill it or anything. So Glenn took the heavy lifting, took it up and cleaned it, milled it, and milled it in stages, so we got it as we needed it. And when we mashed it, it was that beautiful deep burgundy red color. Everything was going great. And then the next morning, we go in and look at the fermentation, and there's this really thick oil cap, which we haven't seen with white or
like
yellow corn.
3.5 inches thick, and it smelled like banana Laffy Taffy.
Whoa.
Yeah. It did not smell like corn, like, you know, we were used to. And we thought, there again, this is going in the right direction. We got it into the still. We don't, you know, oil and everything pumps across, so oil's coming off in the distillate. So there's a viscosity to this distillate and almost like a light spice flavor. And
to answer your original question, So whiskey corn is very different from sweet corn. It's got a really high starch content, so that makes it ideal for making whiskey, and it also makes it ideal for grits, for cornbread. It is not a corn that you can eat off the cob. It's a little too doughy. And that starch that just, like, we have eaten it off the cob, it's terrible, but the starch just completely dries your mouth out. And that also makes it a great tortilla corn. So that was an interesting correlation to make for us. And just the flavor of it is just really robust, really complex. It's not, corn these days has been bred, the flavor has been bred out of corn. So number two dent corn is a Franken corn that is bred for fuel. It's not bred for eating. And when you look at the corn lobby's numbers on where corn goes, I think less than 1% goes to human consumption.
Yeah, we once we distilled it and got it in a barrel, we originally were going to use a quote-unquote flavoring grain. In the bourbon industry, it's usually wheat or rye. Those are the flavoring grains, and they consider corn sugar. Well, this distillate was so complex, we were like, let's just put that in a barrel and see what happens at 100% corn. And people to this day, when they drink it, they're like, is there wheat or rye in here? What's in here? What else is in here? And we're like, it's corn. And they doubt this. And
even Julian Van Winkle.
Yeah. Yeah. So
for weeks.
Yes.
Insisted that we were just not being honest with him about the mash bill.
Is there anyone else that you know of that's using the Jimmy Red Corn in their bourbons?
There are a couple other small distilleries, but the problem is we've had to create our own supply chain.
It sounds like it. And, with the
farming and it's just not that readily available. You can't buy it on, you know, even from a seed exchange, you would only be able to get probably less than 50 pounds, if that. It's not.
Yeah, you wouldn't even be able to get that.
And how much do you need to make, like, your batch?
We use 1,000 pounds in a single batch, and we're getting ready to upgrade our facility, so next year this time we hope to be using 3,500 pounds in one batch. So that's going to up the game and also, you know, really create a lot of work for us to do on the front end of getting that seed in the ground and making sure that we have the supply.
The seed security is we talk a lot about that.
Yeah.
It's very stressful. It costs a lot. It takes a lot of energy. We are just starting to dig back into that, but that was sort of the impetus for this.
Let's talk a little bit about how you had to find this corn.
The lesson here in Ann and Scott are unpredictably, in my view, very loop-like thinkers. They think all the way through things, and I'm not used to dealing with people like that, honestly. My wife is that way, right? Hi, Kay. But the lesson here is, it started with Ted Tuning, who didn't want that corn to go away because he liked everything about the corn, period. And he was very familiar with black culture on James Island. And the last family that had it, kids didn't want to grow it. And so Ted decided to save it himself. And he was pretty quiet about it. And I happened to see him growing it. I didn't even know who he was. And my daughter actually spotted it. So there's Ted, didn't know it was all that unique when he started, but it turns out to be a specific land race, heirloom, that he was saving. I'm not sure that he understood that how much culture was behind it when he got it, but I got some, I blew it up, I gave seed back to him, he gave seed back to me, and we traded back and forth for a couple of years. Then we.
Why does trading it back and forth matter?
Phenotypic plasticity, don't you love it?
Yeah,
it's my favorite term.
Can you define that?
Corn responds to its terroir, just like wine grapes. Which now I'm sitting next to two experts that know about sensory and gastro neurology, et cetera, et cetera. So as you go through those things, you think about gastronomy and how the corn is actually reacting to its sense of place. And it changes. The plant actually can look different in different places too. And what Ted and I were doing was just, here's mine, here's yours, for a couple, 3 years. And then Ted Tuning and I decided, look, you know, it looks like this corn is unique here, and we need to, one, look at it hard, and two, get some pros in here to save it. So we went to Merle Shepherd and Dr. Brian Moore, Dr. Merle Shepherd here at the Clemson University Research Center. And they were intaking, then it was secret that they had a seed vault in there. So I didn't even know they had the seed vault, but they were intaking local stuff into their seed vault, which they still have. It's bomb-proof, hurricane-proof. It's the coolest place in South Carolina, if you like seed. So they took it in, and then Brian, Dr. Brian Ward, grew it out. And that's actually the first person that pulled all this together with Scott and Ann, because they need security. It changes every year, and you have to reselect it. And at Clemson University, they had lots of experience. Ted had lots of experience. He was in on it. And Ted's coming back, right?
We're doing two seed increases this year at two separate farms.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Is Ted working with you this
year? Ted's working with us this year.
Cool.
Which is exciting, and he's very... He just had a grandbaby, his first grandbaby. So
he wanted his daughter to name the baby James.
Baby James?
After
James.
Jimmy Red.
Yeah. I like that.
So every time she posts a picture of the baby, I say, ooh, James Rouge, how's he doing today?
James Rouge. I like it. It's
fancy.
French.
Yeah, but so, I think, well, corn is very promiscuous, so you have to be really careful about where you plant it and when you plant it, because it will get crossed up with corn that's anywhere near it. So we have to really work with farm partners that are very serious and that understand that they are being stewards of a crop that almost went away, and a crop that we're trying to keep as pure as possible and continue in a straight line from a genetic standpoint.
I read somewhere that there was like two cobs left at one point. Is that the case? Or is that a little bit of a...
I think Ted got a little bit more than that, but you're right. It wasn't much.
It was very small.
Yeah, it came from a very, very old family who did not want to be named and still don't.
Wow.
But Ted has the history. He'd be a great book, and I've told my book agent that he should chase Ted down. I don't know where that's going.
So let's talk about the recent trip that Jimmy Red Corn has inspired. And where did you go? Why did you go there? And tell me the story.
I'm going to let Glenn take
that. Well, I'll kick it off, but Scott and Ann, again, had much higher integrity philosophy behind this trip than I did. And it was my contention that there was such a thing as imago de maiz. And it was a difficult decision to figure out whether it was geneticists that are working at the Center for the International Study of Maize and Wheat north of Mexico City, or someplace else, or the Zapotec and the other native peoples in the Mayan communities up and down the Americas, period. And so I just decided, I'd been asking questions, and Kate Barney, who works with Row 7 now, Charlotte Douglas, Dan Barber, Kate Barney had worked with Javier Yavera, founding Macienda, and it's a company that's based on the original 59 Zapotec style mazes from all over, though it's not just Zapotec, so it's all over Mexico, North America, South America. There's not much up here of the origin mazes. And Martha Wilcox, a North Carolina person who has her doctorate, was the person who organized this. And she works for CMIT, and she works for INIFAP, and these are all acronyms. You can look them up online. But they're all people that are postdoc scientists that study maize. And Martha asked me if I'd come down. And I said, oh, yeah. Right, because one of our people that works at Anson Mills lives in Mexico City and works from there. So she went to meet the magos, right? It means magician in Spanish. The whole day was in Spanish, and they, I think, cooked 80 different kinds of maize and served it to her in three different forms. And then she stayed an extra day. She could not believe that she was in this neurogastronomy envelope with a bunch of postdocs eating the best food she'd ever had in her life. She's lived in Mexico City off and on since she was born, right? And so she called me up and she said, I just had the best series of 20 meals I've ever had in 48 hours in my life. And I go, I'm there. What do I do, right? So I called up Ann and Scott because I figured they'd appreciate it. And then I pass it off to them. What happened then?
Well, we definitely, I mean, I reach out to Glenn pretty often with questions because he's been doing this a long time, working with seeds, mainly there again, seed security. Also, I was very interested in sort of southeastern dents and how the migration happened. And I knew that we don't talk a lot in the South, you know, southern food. We talk a lot about the West African diaspora of food, but we don't talk about that diaspora of maize. And really, you know, we all know pieces of it, but it's not been anything really in depth that I know of that's been published that talks about that. So I knew that Cimit existed, and when Glenn mentioned the trip to Cimit possibly, I was like, we're in. We want to go. And then I just continued to say, when are we going? When are we going? When are we going? And
I got to get my plane ticket.
Scott's a little bit upset.
No, Ann's coming. I have to get 2 plane tickets.
I wasn't going to miss it.
I got points. I got to use them. Let's go. Let's go.
And so, yeah, we were really, really anxious. And really, for me, I'd heard about this 59 varieties, but it didn't really make sense to me of like, what does that mean? 59 varieties, exactly. And it wasn't until we got down there that it made complete sense when they had them in the baskets and the different varieties all laid out. And they're like cousins in these baskets. So it wasn't like, oh, there's, you know, 59 cobs. It's like, no, there's 59 sort of families. And we said, okay, well, which one of these is southeastern dent, i.e. Jimmy Red, great-great-great-grandparents? Where are they? Where are their cousins?
So we really, that first time we worked with Jimmy Red, we were so just excited but also a little bit baffled as to how we had not seen anywhere near this result with any corn that we had worked with to that point. And we had worked with a lot of heirlooms, a lot of white corn, some yellow corn, some blue corn. And so it really just made us think, you know, if this is this, what else is out there and how do we go about finding it? So it really only made sense for us to seek it at the source of maize production in the world. And that's, you know, we'd kept our eye on it and we were just really intrigued by what that ancestor corn might look like or taste like. And so we visited those 3 seed banks back to back to back. And we felt like we were getting close. We kept seeing cobs of yellow corn that were clearly dent corns that had, so Jimmy Red has a specific row count of kernels around the cob. And we were, you know, intent on finding that, but also just, we felt like the kernel shape would probably be similar. The cob shape would probably be similar. So it was really fun. And we were also kind of joking the whole time. Like, I think the first day we did see a cob of Tuxpeño, which is what we think is the ancestor corn, but it was yellow. And we were like, does this come in red?
You're like shopping.
Anyone?
Yeah, we both stumbled on it though. We stopped at the second stop in Oaxaca, and we both walked up to this another basket, and we were like, and you could see the blue,
we found
red,
the red one.
We were like, this is the family. And it was really exciting, more of just out of learning more about what do these cousins taste like in relation to Jimmy Red, and sort of as seed security of, like, you know, thinking about what's in there that makes this so special, because we're not scientists. I don't know all the properties. We've done some genetic work with Clemson with basic flavor compounds like furfural and anthocyanine and cinnamic acid and things of that nature, but we don't know. I mean, there's hundreds or thousands of properties in this corn that, you know, we couldn't possibly fund all the research that we would need to do to figure that out. But we're culinary people, so, and Glenn was down there more on, I think, a culinary seed adventure with some other folks that are also interested in the more culinary side. So we said, let's just go down as culinary fans and sort of kind of check out the whole culinary scene and see why they use different mazes for different purposes. I'm very interested in nixtamalization just from a food standpoint. So we got to, it was just crazy. I can't even explain the trip, to be perfectly honest. It was a crazy 3-day deep dive, 14, 16-hour days.
It was intense.
How about 25,000 distinct cultivars of maize in conservancy in three different places in the same number of days? And that doesn't count going to see the real Magos, the Zapotec, out in the foothills.
The true hallmark of just how interesting and overwhelming it was is we'd get back in the van and nobody talked to each other. And these two guys right here can talk a blue streak. But Glenn, the first night, I remember we were going to bed and I was like, did you notice how quiet Glenn was in the van?
Well, it was overwhelming. It was one of the best trips I've ever taken. It was definitely life-changing. Not only from a humanitarian standpoint, because the people were so amazing, but also just the great work that these folks are doing, and seeing how powerful it is that they're preserving this culture, and it's inspiring. So for me, Simit, you can tell Martha is very passionate. I mean, and she loves the farmers. She loves the preservation, but she loves these people because she realizes they're the key. But we went the next day, we flew to Oaxaca. We went to Texcoco the first day to Simit outside Mexico City, did a whole tour of their facility, then got on planes the next morning, flew to Oaxaca, dove right into a restaurant that they make their own masa, mill their own masa, all these different varieties, have this really cool comal right out front they're making tortillas on. I mean, it's just like corn heaven. And then we go from there to this village that's known for tortilla making. And we sit down and they've assembled the dignitaries of the town and they line us up at a table and they're lined up. And then they introduce themselves. We've got the president and maybe the vice president or whatever. But
of
the village. And then we go through and they explain who we all are. And you can tell they're very honored to have us there and very proud to show off what they do. And then we just start walking from house to house. And there are women working apparently 7 days a week from 7 to 3 every day. Over wood fire, turning what they grow, their families grow, into something more valuable, tortillas, and we're tasting yellow, red, blue, then we get to
purple,
and there's chickens and turkeys, donkeys
orange.
And turkeys, and we get
all
to
the
last
turkeys.
One though, and this there's a woman there making tortillas with hybrid corn, because they're introducing hybrids. Trying to say, this is easier. Why are you messing with the ancestral stuff? This is much cheaper and easier. Well, that tortilla suffered from flavor. So it really just cemented in my head of like, this is what we're doing is worthwhile.
Are they distilling with the corn down there?
No.
It's all like food.
No, the mezcal traditions and the palenques. Which does bring up an interesting thing. They do make very elevated spirit ferments with these things that we did not. I'm going back this summer, going to like go there. They use sacred ash in them, their spirit drinks, and they do use maize for those things, and they're supposed to be phenomenal. We had some non-alcoholic drinks that were so far off the charts, I'd never even tasted anything
Tahate,
like it. Which brings, yeah, exactly. Which brings up something that I think I had a conversation with John T. Edge about 12 years ago. He came to look at a cornfield that I was working in for some odd reason. I don't know why. He just showed up. So I was in the neighborhood. I'm going, oh, okay. John T. Edge, director of Southern Foodways Alliance, sorry. And we started talking about Appalachia and source water and the idea that the best hooch in Appalachia is based on the best corn in Appalachia paired with source water, meaning water straight out of the rock. And the concept there is the same thing that Scott and Ann are chasing in my mind, which is source food. And honestly, before this trip even evolved, I hadn't thought about looping what happened. So you need to make sure you tell what you guys discovered down there, which I thought was amazing, once you found where and when. And I'll introduce it by saying what we were told there, which is true, we saw field peas that are all from East Africa, but somehow are documented centuries back on the west coast of Oaxaca. And I've asked every field pea scientist I know how the hell that happened, including the people down there, and nobody knows. Dr. David Shields supposes that it could have been part of the Polynesian exchange, right? Kind of weird, but that means the field peas go way back there. And we also see the expression of those same field peas in Wilmington, North Carolina. John Kirkendall just discovered them last year in a grower that had them in his family forever down there. So the idea of source food starts to become a very serious notion when you're talking about biosecurity for the future and genetics, because these are things we didn't even know we have. Nobody knew we had these kind of, they're black cow peas from Wilmington. David Shields thinks they're kind of like crowders, but it turns out there's something else from the west coast of Oaxaca that's really germane to this whole discussion, which is, where did Jimmy Red really come from?
Right, yeah. So the Tuxpeño variety that we both sort of walked up on at our second stop in Oaxaca. Second. We went to lunch, or kind of a late brunch.
In a FAP.
And they had all the baskets out, and we both walked up and both separately took photos of this basket, and we were both sort of ran to each other, and we're like, we think we found something here. And it's low elevation, coastal, and
it's grown below 1,000 feet.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
On the coast.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Charleston's at 12 on a hill.
Very tall.
So we showed some photos to what's the guy's name?
Talking about Jim Holland, Smitty.
Flavio? No. Flavio?
Flavio.
Oh, yeah. Flavio Aragon.
From INIFAP, yeah.
Yeah. So Dr. Flavio Aragon from
INIFAP. So who runs,
INIFAP. Thank you,
who
Flavio.
Runs that station, and we showed him some photos of the Jimmy Red, and he was like sort of lit up and was like, oh, I grow that. I grow something like that down near the coast. And so we immediately were like, okay, we need to go to the coast.
Flavio's our guy.
Yeah. So we're going back this year.
The coast is also like 7.5 hours by car from Oaxaca City. Yeah. So we immediately were like, how long would it take for us to get down there? Could we do this now? And then I was like, there's no way. We would have missed too much on the rest of that journey.
And also we want to be obviously there when we're close to harvest.
Yeah.
And trips like these tend to breed more questions than answers. And we immediately wondered what the path was from the west coast of Oaxaca to Charleston, South Carolina for Jimmy Red. And the researchers, I feel like, tend to operate in silos because their research is so important to them. So we've had a little bit of a hard time getting people to talk to each other about, you know, what they know in order to connect these dots. But we think it came up probably through the American Southwest and then went east. But in talking to a few people we've talked to, there's some fascinating seed history that we had never considered. And one is that it may have been grown here in the 1800s, but after the Civil War, a lot of Southern planters uprooted and went to Brazil because slavery was still legal there, and they could take all their slaves and continue farming the way that they always had. So when you pick up a seed like that and take it to another place, you pick up a whole different DNA, essentially. The DNA converts. But also terroir. You've got different terroir. And you've also got potential of intermingling with Brazilian varietals that would also have come down from Mexico. So there's this whole other bizarro, maybe, you know, intermingling. And then a lot of those planters moved back after Reconstruction. So you've got this crazy, you know, there's all these variables that could have possibly happened. And it's picking up with every move, that you know, group makes out of Oaxaca, north into the southwestern U.S., and then east, you get, you know, a different little twist to the DNA with every planting. So that's fascinating. And then Scott talked to somebody a couple weeks ago that also mentioned how much was lost with the Trail of Tears and how these Native American groups, as they were moved back west, lost their land, they lost their seeds.
Yeah. So I think ultimately, I felt like it was like, is this a long shot? But I feel like it's the best we're going to do. And I think even talking to people who do this for a living, who, and multiple people who do this for a living, the best we're going to be able to do is piece together our best theory around sort of a general theory. And all of them sort of say the same thing, which is it moved them to the southwest and across the bottom of the country and up over here. After that, you know, we don't really know exactly, but we're doing genetic fingerprinting with Dr. Jim Holland with USDA. There's a germplasm center at CIMMYT that we will also be speaking with about Tuxpeño genetics and trying to use a little bit of science to see if we can't sort of piece some pieces. So it's going to be coming at it from multiple angles to sort of construct this theory. And really, at the end of the day, we're distillers. You know, I mean, we're...
No, because we do have to wrap up in just a second, but... This has been so fascinating. I've loved doing this another year to talk about a very specific ingredient, how this insane amount of work goes into working with that ingredient, but then translating it into something that's just really delicious. So on that note, Ann Scott, tell us where people can find the Jimmy Red Bourbon and more about High Wire.
Yes, so our sort of number one online outlet right now is Astor Wines in New York City, and they carry most of our products, and they have done a really good job of stocking Jimmy Red and making sure they still have it. We release it generally at the end of the year. That's our big annual release. But this year we are hoping to have it available all year round. And it is a beautiful spirit. All of the things that we've talked about the corn, the oil, the flavor, the cinnamic acid, all of those things translate into the spirit. So it's got this really creamy mouthfeel, this amazing viscosity. It's got some notes of marzipan, some baking spice that's coming from that cinnamic acid, which is linked to the color red. And then it's just, you know, it's such a cool product because it's 100% corn. It's the only bourbon I know of. I was actually with Bill Thomas from Jack Rose yesterday, and I asked him, you know, if he knows of any other 100% corn bourbon, and he could not name one. So
yeah, we've stumped a lot of whiskey enthusiasts, but that's really cool. I will mention that we have distilled some other varieties. We distilled some blue corn from Mexico about 2 years ago, sort of secretly, quietly, and we've been tasting that recently. And this has a real high level of the anthocyanin, which is in blueberries and Aussie. And it has almost like a brandy nose, but we tasted it side by side with the Jimmy Red. Completely different flavor. Richness, mouthfeel, all of that. Some of the characteristics, but completely different. So we're just sort of starting to scratch the surface is basically the point of this. So
That's cool.
And Glenn, my last question for you is, if we do this next year, what ingredient are we talking about then?
I think we should be talking about the recovery of Italy's oldest rice out of the Sicilian exchange that came to the Salzburger Mill in the 1730s, which is right by Savannah, Georgia. The archives there are pretty thorough, and there's someone doing postdoc work who isn't a postdoc. His name's Justin Cherry. He's a chef here in town, and he has half-ground baking, and he's doing the definitive work looking at colonial rices, amongst other things. So it would be something like that, or something we find between now and then. And the last note, you never know what you have. You need to check really carefully. If somebody says, oh yeah, they do that someplace else. Our friend Nat Bradford was told by an internationally recognized geneticist that his stuff wasn't unique, and he just kept at it, and it was. And with Jimmy Red, it would have gone were it not for Ted Chuning. Yeah. We wouldn't even be sitting here talking about this. That's pretty extraordinary. And that's just two. Can you imagine? There were 120-some thousand distinct maize cultivars by 1900 registered with the USDA. At that time, the Department of Agriculture. Nothing.
How many are there now, Glenn?
It's 23,025 distinct worldwide, not just here.
And to that point, you know, like Bloody Butcher, which is another red corn, if you order Bloody Butcher seed right now, you don't really know what you're getting.
Yeah, it's just a class of corn.
Yeah.
It's just a class.
So
it could have 10 things in it or it could have nothing in it. It's hard to say. It's got red pericarp. That's the outer skin.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for sitting down with me to talk about. I mean, you had me at Oaxaca, but then obviously I wanted
Kat, you have to come.
We're going up. When are we going, Glenn? When are we going?
Planting.
I got to book my ticket.
And harvest.
June 24th is the planting.
It's November, right?
I'll put it in my calendar.
Yeah, we're going to all make Kate Barney help us this time.
All right. I'm putting it in my calendar. You guys aren't going to be able to get rid of me.
When do we need to buy our plane tickets?
All right. Thank you to Glenn Roberts, Ann Marshall, Scott Blackwell. I'm Kat Johnson. Thank you again to Le Creuset and the Julia Child Foundation for making Heritage Radio Network on tour at Charleston Wine and Food possible. Make sure that you go listen or check out our full schedule of the festival at heritageradionetwork.org/Charleston2019. We will have all of our interviews posted very soon for you to listen on demand. So make sure you're staying tuned to the website. And we'll be back shortly with more interviews from the festival.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.